From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Ali Soufan. He's author of the new book, The Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State. He is a former supervisory FBI agent, currently CEO of the Soufan Group. A native of Lebanon who immigrated to the United States, Ali Soufan served on the front lines against al-Qaeda and gained an international reputation as a top counterterrorism operative and interrogator. He has spent more than two decades investigating and analyzing al-Qaeda and its offshoots. In early 2011, from his hideout in Pakistan, Osama bin Laden witnessed the chaos emanating from the so-called Arab Spring. Popular revolts against authoritarian regimes shook the Middle East, toppling governments in Tunisia and Egypt, with Libya and Yemen soon to follow. Bin Laden was about to shift strategies from focusing on Western targets to exploiting regional chaos within the Muslim world and developing local al-Qaeda affiliates. But by May 2011, Bin Laden was dead, killed by U.S. special forces. However, according to Ali Soufan, 6 years later, Bin Laden's message still remains potent, and al-Qaeda's affiliates are more powerful, widespread, and better equipped than ever. The so-called Islamic State, al-Qaeda's most brutal spin-off, may be failing in its effort to create a caliphate, but al-Qaeda remains a threat. In Anatomy of Terror, Ali Soufan dissects bin Laden's brand of jihadi terrorism and its major offshoots, explaining how we got here from that moment in 2011 and how the threat could be countered. Ali Soufan argues that to eliminate the scourge of terrorism, we must first know who the enemy is and what his motivations are. While Ali has been a frequent guest on Press Conference USA, this is his first time at the VOA studio in Washington. Ali Soufan, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Carol, Jeff.
We're glad to have you here in our studio. Congratulations on your book.
Thanks.
And first, let me ask you a basic question. What was the impetus and the objective in writing this book?
16 years after 9/11, we still do not have a deep understanding of the enemy that we're facing. And you have a lot of books about terrorism, about national security. I actually wrote another book called The Black Banners about these issues. But I think what the American people need, they need a way to explain it without talking about the geopolitical issues, without talking about national security policies. We're not talking about pointing fingers at each other politically or institutionally. So I decided to write a book about a novel. The individuals in this novel are real characters. And I hope the reader, by delving into the personality and delving into the character of each and every one of these individuals who created and caused so much damage, so much bloodshed, they will have a deeper understanding of the enemy that we're facing. So when I talk about al-Qaeda, I talk about al-Qaeda at its different stages. And every stage, you see it through the eyes of one of the characters. So since al-Qaeda was defeated in Afghanistan and, you know, most of their leaders were arrested or put in jail, that era, you see it and you understand it through Osama bin Laden. So the character of Osama bin Laden introduces al-Qaeda from the time they were defeated in Afghanistan until he was killed in 2011. And then through Saif al-Adel, his security chief, who was the interim leader after bin Laden's death, you see al-Qaeda from the beginning to Ayman Zawahiri, who's going to be the interim leader. So through him, I introduce all the affiliates and the leaders of all the affiliates. I try to explain their motivations, why they joined the group, how do they see the world. And we talk about the complexity sometimes of the relationships between some of these affiliates and between al-Qaeda. For example, the affiliates in East Africa was led by a terrorist known as Haroon, who has been with al-Qaeda from from the very beginning, and he was instrumental in establishing a Shabab movement. But Harun did not want to give a bayah to Ayman Zawahiri. He thought Ayman Zawahiri was a freeloader. He's an Islamic Egyptian jihad who fooled bin Laden. So Ayman Zawahiri had a problem to get the loyalty from a Shabab until suddenly Harun was killed at a checkpoint. And then the Shabab movement and Al-Qaeda's affiliate in East Africa gave bayah. But the most troublesome affiliate was Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And I have a whole chapter about Al-Qaeda in Iraq through the eyes of the founder of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. So through al-Zarqawi, you understand how important the Iraq war was to Al-Qaeda. So I am not criticizing the Iraq war as an American. I'm not talking about the disaster we've seen from our invasion of 2003. You read it through the enemy's perspective. Zarqawi's relationship with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda was troublesome. Zarqawi had a different vision of jihad than bin Laden had. He wanted to focus more on the takfiri side of jihad, that means fighting other Muslims, killing other Muslims, rather than fighting even the U.S. Many Sunnis in Iraq were really frustrated, not only because of his killings of Shia or blowing up Shiite mosques. They were also more frustrated about him executing Sunni tribal leaders in Al-Anbar province alone, which is a Sunni province in Iraq. Zarqawi assassinated 250 Sunni scholars trying to evacuate the Sunni areas from any legitimate theological leadership. That angered many Islamists in Iraq. Some of them are big supporters of Osama bin Laden, and they told bin Laden that, you know, you're going to be responsible in front of God for all the killings that's happening under your name in Iraq. So you see the different dynamics and the roots that caused later the Islamic State. And then we shift into another character, was Zawahiri, because now he get all the bayat from everyone. He is the leader of the group. And through Zawahiri, you introduce the history of the Middle East in a way, from the time that he was fighting Sadat to the time that he took the leadership. And then we continue through different characters to understand the war in Syria, to understand the complexity of the current situation, and to predict how the new leadership of this movement is going to be. I think the book make it clear that we morphed from organizational terrorism to a message. We are fighting a message now. So yes, we killed bin Laden in May of 2011, but his message lives.
Indeed. You say in the book, we killed the messenger, but not the message. We're talking with Ali Soufan, the author of Anatomy of Terror. You're listening to The Voice of America. Let me turn to my colleague, Jeff Seldon, for a question.
I want to get back to the beginning of something you started talking about when describing why you wrote the book and about explaining to the American people why this is so important and how to understand it. A lot of the decisions, though, come from the political side, the political system. What is it that the political system, you think, continually seems to miss about understanding this type of threat? We've had sometimes heated discussions over terminology, how to describe the threat. But are there certain essential points that the political system as a whole seems not to get that has made it more difficult for the U.S. to take on these challenges?
That's a very good question. But basically, the answer is in the lack of information, even for our political leaders. I mean, if you look back at the campaign and the terminology that we used in the campaign, the moment President Trump went to the White House and the moment he had to travel and address the Muslim world in Riyadh, suddenly all these terminologies changed. Suddenly, they start getting the briefs of exactly what's happening on the ground, that we are not in a clash of civilization with Islam, and Islam is not in a clash of civilization with us. There is an intercivilizational clash that's happening within the Muslim world, and we kind of have it also in the Western world. So in the Muslim world, you have Sunnis fighting Shia, Kurds fighting Turks, Turks fighting Arabs, Arabs fighting Persians, everybody fighting each other. So this is a significant incubating factor for what we see today in the Middle East, and it's giving a lot of strength to extremist groups like Al-Qaeda and like ISIS. So one of the things that I tried to do in the book is to help people understand the threat that we're facing. That's why I didn't want to write just another terrorism book. I thought if you can write it in a novel, if you can write it as if, let's say, Michael Lewis writing about Wall Street, people will have the tendency to read it, understand it, and make their own judgment. So when a politician is saying something, they'll say, that's not going to work. This is not how these people see it. A lot of times, our actions or our rhetoric feeds into these groups. And that's why it's important to understand, you know, it's a disaster. Every time there's an investigation about something that went wrong, you hear our politicians saying, we could not imagine that could have happened. I mean, the 9/11 Commission famously said that the attack was a failure of imagination. Wolfowitz, when he testified in front of Congress, he said, we could not imagine that it will take more troops to secure Iraq than it's going to take down Saddam and his security forces. Always, we cannot imagine. Well, the reason we say that is because our imagination is always limited by our knowledge, is always limited by our understandings of the past, by our expertise. It's limited by our own perceptions. So that's why we have to expand our imagination by using empathy. And I'm not saying empathy from colloquial sense here. You know, I'm not talking about sympathy. I'm talking about empathy from a clinical sense, understanding the enemy on a deeper level, delving into their personalities, understanding their motivation. That is the type of understanding that we need today. The people and the political leaders, we need that type of understanding to basically answer the call that Sun Tzu said hundreds of years ago, if you know your enemy and know yourself, you will win 100 times in 100 battles. Unfortunately, 16 years after 9/11, we kind of forget about who we are as a nation, and we definitely do not have that understanding of our enemy. Your question is a perfect example. Jeff, you have our political leaders fighting with each other. What do they call that threat?
Are there some historical precedents or historical models that might be helpful in re-engineering or redirecting the American view? A lot of times America likes to look at the great evil, whether it's Hitler or Stalin or the communist threat, and just paint it as good versus evil.
Right.
But are there some more useful historical comparisons that might help so that people can understand, okay, maybe it's not like this, more like this, so they can then imagine what needs to happen next, what the U.S. needs to do next.
And that's why I wrote this book, because through the characters, you will have a better understanding of this. Look, let me be clear here. What we're fighting, the ideology that was put forth back in the 90s by Osama bin Laden, has a lot of historical roots. And these historical roots can be theological, can be religious, but they are also political. So we have to be very clear about that. And that ideology of Osama bin Laden, the narrative of Osama bin Laden, is an evil narrative. So it is a battle between good and evil. Good, not only represented in the United States, but humanity in general. And evil, these guys who think it's okay to go and kill little girls leaving a concert, right? I mean, this is as evil as it gets. So I think what we need to do is basically have a deeper understanding of what feeds into that narrative and what feeds into the ideology. Today, for example, we talked about how this threat, the terrorism threat since 2001, mutated. So now we're not talking about organizations. We're talking more and more about a narrative, about an ideology. So if we're talking about a message, we have to have an understanding. What is that message? What makes people do the things that they are doing? For example, sectarianism emerged as a big factor in creating a lot of division in the Muslim world. These groups are directly benefiting from it. That's something started, actually, by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who is the father, if you want to call, or the godfather, if you want to call him, for the so-called Islamic State. The other thing is the chaotic environment in places like Syria, in places like Yemen, in places like Somalia, in places like Libya. You know, these vacuums that exist today and the civil war are directly contributing to the strength of these organizations. So you cannot say, I'm going going to fight terrorism. I'm going to drown this radical message while you have raging civil wars that directly benefiting these groups in all these places. It's like trying to put down a big fire in a kitchen with a small little towel when the stove is still open. So we need to address this from a political and diplomatic perspective. There are other things, the narrative itself. You know, when they say the United States and the West are at war with Islam, right? And we have to retaliate for them killing women and children in Iraq and in Syria, in Yemen, and all the rhetoric that we hear from them. But then you see 95% of the victims of this message, of this narrative, are all Muslims. You see them beheading more Muslims than anyone else. You see them destroying marketplaces in Beirut or in Baghdad, blowing up mosques in Kuwait, or even the mosque of the Prophet in Medina in Saudi Arabia. What are you talking about? The West is at war with Islam. They are at the war with Islam.
Exactly.
We need to expose them for the heretics and the hypocrites that they really are.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our special guest is Ali Soufan, author of The Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State. He's also the CEO of the Soufan Group. That's a strategic intelligence consultancy based in New York City. I'm Carol Castiel, and joining me on the program is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Sule Mele, who recently visited our Facebook page. And if you want to hear your name on the air, write to us at PCUSA@voanews.com. What insights have you gleaned from our conversation with Ali Soufan? Well, Ali Soufan, I want to pick up where you left off, because it seems that the United States in particular, but other countries, are so bent and determined to militarily defeat terrorism. But as you said very eloquently, and as you write in your book, there's not a military solution. You have to attack the message. And you can't even just see it from a Salafi jihadist point of view, in the sense that we're seeing the so-called Islamic State, other offshoots of Al-Qaeda, again, attacking not just Western targets, but Muslims themselves. But what about, for example, secular leaders? Let's talk about Bashar al-Assad. Perhaps the ideology that motivates him, he's a secular leader, and yet he uses these horrible tactics on his own people. To what extent do you see some kind of a weird fusion between the misuse of Salafi Islam, the distortion of its theology for violent ends that we see Al-Qaeda using in Islamic State? But what about sometimes these secular authoritarian leaders who are equally brutal, but they sort of somehow escape blame because the others seem so much more heinous?
And this would create a lot of complexity. For example, when the Arab Spring was unfolding, Osama bin Laden was basically watching television 24/7. He decided to change the whole strategy of Al-Qaeda. He wrote a letter to his commanders that was found at his hideout, and he basically said, forget everything I told you before about just focusing on the United States and just focusing on the West. This is a historical moment that we did not see since the time of Saladin. So we need to basically go to, I'm paraphrasing here, stage two of Al-Qaeda. You know, at the beginning, they wanted to do a lot of terrorist attacks in the West and against American targets around the world to make America weaker so the United States won't come to support the dictators that he claims they do the job for the U.S. locally. Let's just hit the head of the snake. If we cut the head of a snake, all these arms will die, right? So he had his own form of Hydra, where the United States is the neck and all these heads will die if you cut the neck off. So that's why he wanted to focus specifically on the United States. During the Arab Spring, he realized that the United States now is so weak because of what he called the blessed attacks on 9/11. It's so weak to get involved in the Arab and the Muslim world anymore. So now they have to basically capitalize on the chaos that exists. He did not want people to find a situation where someone else, a leader, especially democratically elected leader, take over. Because that will be a disaster, because that person, Bin Laden said, is going to work directly with the West. He is going to be the new dictator. So what he decided to do is to keep that chaos going on. And he said, I know what I'm saying means a lot of Muslims need to die or will die. And he continued in his letter to say, but we have to kill them to save them. So this is basically straight out of the management of savagery of Al-Qaeda. First, prevent the enemy of supporting the local dictators that they have. Second, don't allow anybody to manage that chaos except yourself. Third, you establish a state and you have a final confrontation with the West. So Al-Qaeda is in stage two based on the orders that Osama bin Laden gave just before he died. ISIS, because of their problem with Zawahiri, went straight to stage three. And this is where the problem is between these two organizations. So they are benefiting from people like Assad. They were benefiting from chaos that exists in different places. Absolutely, they benefit.
But Assad also seems to benefit from them. It's almost as if they have some kind of a tacit agreement because, they're, again, preventing any type of real democratic uprising. I'm not saying these are born Democrats, but in the region, there is a desire.
We have to be careful about the term Democrats. One of the problems that we in the West are the biggest hypocrites. I mean, we had Egyptians elected democratically a person that we did not like, and then we supported a coup to get rid of that person. So either we're going to support democratic reform, or we don't want to support democratic reform.
Well, that's exactly
what's happening.
Well, absolutely.
I mean, we use these extremists to fight the Russians. And when they defeated the Russians, he's like, okay, now you're not Mujahideen anymore. Now we consider you terrorists. This is actually feeding into that narrative.
It's very complicated.
It is very complicated, but one of the things that seems clear is that Al-Qaeda has always had this long-term strategy, thinking beyond the next 4 years, the next election.
Yeah.
Given the West and its political structures rooted in democracy, where there are elections periodically, can the West come together and fight, it's not so much a war, but fight a war of ideas with that type of long-term strategy when the political leadership of the West is going to be changing ever so often?
Well, when it comes to national security, we always focused on the long term. And our national security strategies and plans did not shift dramatically with administrations, right? So I think what we need to do is use all tools available in our toolbox. Look, the military options, intelligence options is definitely part of the strategy. In the same time, we need to do whatever we can in order to prevent more recruits from joining this. And this is where diplomacy is extremely important. This is where aid programs are extremely important. We need to give more money to State Department, more money to USAID, not to slash their budget. This is where engaging regional powers and even international powers and local players to find political solutions for problems in Yemen or problems in Syria or problems in Iraq is extremely important, because if we don't do that, if we only think about military solution, this is going to come back and hurt our efforts, and it's going to only help the extremists. So we have to utilize all the tools available in the toolbox and develop a comprehensive strategy. So far, 16 years after 9/11, I cannot imagine that we still do not have a comprehensive strategy. We have tactics, but we don't have a strategy. Some of these tactics are successful. Like drones. Drones are successful. They take out leaders. They disrupt the plots. Every now and then, unfortunately, you hit the wrong target, and that feeds into the narrative of the bad guys. So if you're not fighting that narrative, you're going to be on the losing end. But using drones is not a strategy. It is just a tactic. So we need to have a comprehensive strategy that includes all these different components to it. And we need to empower people, especially civil society, to stand up against all rhetorics of hate, to include extremism, not only here in the United States, but around the world. The government is not a credible voice. The moment the United States government talk about these things, it's going to lose credibility. You need to empower people in the Middle East to stand up. Unfortunately, our relationships are all with governments in the Middle East, and some of these governments don't want people to speak out in a free way in their own society, even if they are speaking against the terrorists. And this is part of the complexity of the problem.
Well, what about Ali Soufan, homegrown terrorists, and how we can attack this scourge? For example, one of the more successful countries coming out of the Arab Spring, it's still a very fragile situation, Tunisia.
Yeah.
But we see so many foreign fighters coming from Tunisia, going to Syria. Right. Just so the need to bolster a country like Tunisia is also, I would think, in your view, important. But what about prison systems that are incubators also of these people who, yes, commit crimes, but somehow we need a different way to deal with them?
Absolutely. And if you read the book, you will see all the top leaders of the Islamic States were all together in the same jail, in Buka camp, jail operated by us, by the U.S. military. They actually met each other over there. So you have the crazy jihadis met with the very strategic Baathists, and they create a Frankenstein that half Bin Laden, half Saddam.
Right.
And that happened in a U.S. jail. If you see all the top extremists and terror leaders even in Syria, from al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, even some Ahrar al-Sham people, they all came from the Sidana jail in Syria. 80% almost of those who traveled from Belgium to join the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, 80% literally of those guys have criminal records, and they were in jail, and they were radicalized while meeting different radical people in jail. So we have a problem with this. If you see Ayman Zawahiri himself, he was further radicalized because of the experiences that he suffered from when he was jailed after the assassination of Sadat. So there are a lot of things to think about when it comes to the importance of jail. But I want to go back to the Tunisia question. And yes, the highest number of foreign fighters who joined the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria come from Tunisia, about 6,000 we counted. But we have to be very careful not to connect the Arab Spring to that. Zarqawi, before he died, when he had control in Fallujah back in 2005, he said there's a small little town in Tunisia called Bin Ghurdan. If it was next to Fallujah, we could have liberated Iraq. And Bin Ghurdan continued to have a high percentage of foreign fighters who continue to travel to places like Iraq and places like Syria. So the fact that there were thousands of people joining the global jihadi movement from Tunisia is something started way before the Arab Spring. We talked earlier about how Zarqawi was killing Sunnis in Iraq and killing Shia in Iraq. His shock troops at the time were all from North Africa, Libyans and Tunisians. So we have to keep that in mind. This pipeline has been established way before the Arab Spring.
Indeed.
You know, the temptation is to cut off the head of the terrorist groups and the terror groups, but would it be a more effective strategy, do you think, to set perhaps smaller goals, but as part of this long-term strategy, if you take away some of the smuggling routes in one place or take away other abilities in another place, leading up to then decapitate the terrorist organizations?
We need an out-front confrontation, absolutely. And I agree with you 100%. That's why we need a comprehensive strategy that includes diplomacy, that includes intel, that includes military, that includes law enforcement, that includes working together. We need to basically take a step back and say, okay, how do we defeat that enemy? And sometimes there are people that we need to defeat militarily and take out, but as long as they continue to have new recruits, the war will continue forever. The last chapter in the book is slaying the Hydra. What do we need to do in order to do that? And I talk about all these different elements that we need to fight the battle that we are facing today, not that we had at 9/11, because it morphed, it mutated. It's not an organization anymore, it's a message. So what makes this message potent? What makes it potent is sectarianism. What makes it potent is civil war, vacuums, regional powers, using sectarianism to settle score against each other and create a geopolitical sphere of influence. Iran and Saudi Arabia, the apparent hypocrisy that people in the Middle East see in the West. Imagine you had President Trump in Saudi Arabia, and he was talking about he got a few $100 billion from the Saudis for jobs, jobs, jobs in America. And he's saying that in front of 50 leaders from the Muslim world, where supposedly that speech was a speech to the Muslim world. Well, think about what's happening in Yemen today. People cannot even find food. Most of the countries in the Middle East, the Muslim countries, don't have electricity. They don't have infrastructures. Muslim youth, especially in the Middle East, a high percentage, more than 60%, they don't even have jobs, to include in Saudi Arabia. So here, those people who have no hope, who have no future, who have no electricity, who have nothing, they see this lavish event with this bragging, he got hundreds of billions of money to be invested in the United States. This is exactly what Osama bin Laden talked about in 1996, that they are stealing your money in order to get protection for these leaders. And you're going to see that message coming back again now. This is a very potent message, and we have to be very, very careful on how to counter it. We need to counter it. We need to drown it, not brag about it.
The book is The Anatomy of Terror. The author, Ali Soufan, he's CEO of the Soufan Group. Ali, once again, congratulations on your
book. Thank you.
And thank you for coming into the studio.
Always a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. And joining me on the program was VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.